You're listening to the Friends Electric Podcast, Episode 3. It's about time. For past and future episodes of this podcast, go to friendselectric.com. Welcome to the Friends Electric Podcast. This is your host, Tyler Sticca, and with me as always is your wonderful co-host, Peter Woolley. How are you doing, Peter?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing well, getting over my I might sound a little bluesy this podcast because I'm getting over a throat cold. That's why we were originally going to record this last Saturday, but we had to wait till this weekend to record it. So here we are, though, and we're both alive. I'm alive. Are you alive?
I'm still alive.
Cool.
You can believe it.
You're staying alive. So it's been just a killer not being able to record a podcast with you the last several weeks. Things have been busy, but it's been a great time for web designers. Lots of just really cool tools, and especially if you're a standards-minded designer. I think I've never been so excited by all the shiny new toys I get to experiment with.
Indeed. I think top of that list, at least for me, would have to be, as strange as it sounds to say, would be IE9.
Yes.
I keep seeing these developer previews, and I am impressed. I think I did not get the first one, because even though they were saying things, I just wasn't that shocked. But man, I've been getting these recent ones, and watching them do, especially with that hardware acceleration, they are pushing the bar. IE, Microsoft, is pushing the bar. It's great to see this.
Absolutely. And what I've been surprised by is exactly what you were just saying. Excuse my keyboard sounds. I'm loading up some stuff in it right now. It's just this it's just this interesting aspect of it, which is that it's not like they just implemented, say, Canvas, which they did. That was the exciting news that they dropped relatively recently, was right. Like, oh, and by the way, we fully support Canvas now, when they weren't sure they were going to. But it's the fact that you know, I hesitate to say, because I'm no expert on the cross-browser consistency issues with that tag, but it seems to be, on first glance, the best implementation of Canvas. Not that it has anything that the other ones don't, but the fact that it does have that hardware acceleration, it's very speedy, and it works just like any other browser, just faster than the other ones. And it's really great to see what is, if we're being honest, the world's flagship browser, the one that most people are using. It's great to see them actually kind of try to hop ahead. Even if they aren't inventing the technology, they're at least making an effort to make sure that it's implemented the best possible way, so it isn't immediately leapfrogged.
Yeah, I think a lot of the functionality that we are getting in these new browsers, since it's coming along in IE9, I think I no longer think of IE9 as the scourge of what we have to deal with. And so I'm reminded, and you just reminded me of, because like we can kind of look at what we can use. I'm reminded of caniuse.com, and I love this thing. And just like basically check out all the cool things that are coming as far as the web is concerned, in both HTML5, CSS3, all that sort of stuff. And so now the Canvas, both the Canvas basic support and Canvas text APIs, say that yes, you can use them in IE9, which obviously will be, you know, 2011 or later if you're targeting your mass audiences. But to see that we now have a green bar to show that all of the major browsers are going to support Canvas, and all the crazy stuff that we've already seen. I know later we'll be talking about some things on 10K apart, a list of parts, a little, I guess, JavaScript HTML5 app contest. A lot of the stuff in there, really cool stuff. I know the stuff you did stuff in there as well. But just a ton of cool stuff with Canvas that can be built with just this minimal amount of code. And right now it's going to work in every, or as we move forward, it's going to work in every browser. That's
right.
Just awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing. And that's sort of followed up by the cool announcement. So first we had the announcement from Google that they had essentially bought some open source. Was VP8 the name of the open source codec that they bought, or was that what they ended up calling it? I can never remember.
That is a good question.
I think they bought that, and it's something like WebV or something like that.
WebVM? Is that? That's,
yeah.
Things are slowly coming together.
Yes, absolutely. We should have done more of our homework on
this. We should have done. No, WebVM is totally so. Is it just WebM? Oh.
Yes, WebM. That is
all right.
It.
Thank hey, it didn't take us very long.
We have a winner. Yes, thank you, Google, for reminding us. So they bought WebM, and then everyone, you know, joined hands and sang songs. Like, okay, mm-hmm. great. These guys finally stepped in. Because what we had talked about on our previous shows, for those who don't remember because it's been a while, is that the problem with HTML5 video is that the standard that was established by the WebKit browsers was H.264, which, like a lot of formats that we sort of take for granted, like MP3s, is a licensed format. It's not... Mm-hmm. In the short term, I forgot what the holding company is, but they were offering it royalty-free, but there was a deadline on how long it was going to remain royalty-free. And so open-source companies like Mozilla, not companies, but nonprofits like Mozilla, mm-hmm. said, we don't want any part of that. We don't want to establish that as the standard for the web, only to have the rug pulled out from under us later and mm-hmm. have to compromise our open-sourcedness because of the royalties. And so, and then Apple... said we won't be supporting those open source codecs because they tend to, whether they know it or not, they may be infringing on patents for right. the royalty ones. And so it was just this big mess. Google steps in and says, okay, we'll be the ones to kind of put our neck out on the line. We're going to buy this competing codec. We're going to open source it. So use that. Apple still kind of was wavering. They still held on to, okay, even though Google owns it, that doesn't mean it's any less likely to infringe on patents. And so then everyone's kind of cheering sort of subsided. And then finally, I think it was just this week, the holding company announced that H.264 is going to remain royalty-free, basically indefinitely. And while this doesn't mean it is necessarily an open-source codec, it is nice to hear them basically decide that, okay, if it's a choice between getting royalties down the line or maintaining our position as a dominant format and being able to leverage that, I think it's a smart decision for them to have said, you know what, we're well on our way to being the dominant format, let's uh-huh. just be that instead of this old mentality of we need, you know, pennies from every browser maker.
Yeah, and this, I still... From hearing this news, it's exciting, and I think that we kind of are in a place where we're moving towards like video that's going to work on the web. I can tell that, but I'm still, from some of the things I read, I'm still a little. I guess I'm more confused because it doesn't sound completely solved, but this definitely feels like a big step, and so, yeah, I guess what I would really like to see is now implementations in all of them that work perfectly.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, but I guess at least we're over this whole issue, or we might be over this issue of licensings and patents and stuff. I know that another issue that this feels like it's reminiscent of is the whole Google Oracle Java dealio, where Oracle is suing Google for having their implementation of Java, and they're saying they can't do it for Android and all this mess. And it just reminds me, like, how much patents and licensing and all this really gets in the way of innovation, and right. how the nice part at least is that like little people, I'm using little people even for the term for Android for Google, like, you know, when it's not that big of a thing, or it's not that big yet, or it's not making that much money, people don't really go after you, or seemingly they don't really go after you. But as soon as it gets big enough, then you run into these issues. So it's almost terrifying, and I can definitely understand why Apple would be, you know, be filled with trepidation and be worried about these things and not want to do it. So hopefully now all these issues really are resolved, and we can move on to implementations.
Yeah, certainly. And one thing that's nice too is that HTML5. Because they created HTML5 with that idea of paving cow paths and backwards compatibility.
Right.
Every one of these media tags has sort of built into it the opportunity to fall back. And while no one likes having to encode videos multiple times for multiple formats, it is nice to know that you don't necessarily have to resort to sort of hackish methods of, feature detection. Well, feature detection isn't a hackish method, but even browser detection to figure out which format you should use. You can just list them sequentially within the video or the audio tag, as it may be,
yeah.
and let things gracefully degrade or progressively enhance. Whatever you, it's kind of both in this situation. But
yeah.
And speaking of HTML5, You know, if you would have told me a year ago how quickly HTML5 was ramping up in support for it and that I would be able to use it as kind of my default on projects before the end of 2010, I would have probably said you were being overly optimistic. And I'm so, so happy to see that I can actually... It's really easy to start writing with HTML5. Even if you're writing in mostly XHTML syntax, mm-hmm. you can really set yourself up for success now and gain some of the use of the features and everything and get your apps and your sites ready to enhance as soon as the browser features allow it. And we're seeing some really great tools come out, and there's been a few in the past. You know, the classic one is HTML5 Shiv, which is the simplest, and that's right. the one that's you can get from the Google CDN, and it allows you to it basically forces old school browsers, mainly IE, to recognize the new HTML5 features. This will, of course, no longer be necessary in IE9 because IE9 plays nice with them.
Right.
But then you have Modernizer, which has been out for a little while, and it was featured on a list apart and is not available on a CDN yet, unfortunately. But it allows you to do more crazy feature detection with JavaScript or CSS. But there's a new one out right now called HTML5 Boilerplate. What is the boilerplate, Peter?
So the HTML5 boilerplate, put out by, I know in large part, by Paul Irish, a fellow that I particularly enjoy, basically calls it a rock-solid default for HTML5 awesome. And it essentially is a grouping of files, starting with an index.html file and then a CSS file and some basic scripts and JavaScript. And it's there basically to include all of the kind of tried and true and as well as up-and-coming methods for getting really solid HTML5 markup in your new app. So you kind of just download this thing, you get a zip file of all these, and the idea is that you go through, it's delete key friendly, you go through and take what you want out of it, or you leave what you want there, and remove the stuff that you don't need. And so the stuff that you get is like, you get basic stuff like your standard HTML5 doc type, which is, you know, the simplest and best doc type. I just love it so much. But then, you know, great techniques, like they include where you would want to put Modernizer to utilize that. They've got Paul Irish had a blog post about using conditional style sheets or CSS hacks, and there's a solution in there for setting a class using conditional comments on your body to determine which version of IE is being used, if any, and then you can use that class in your CSS without having to use any hacks, and so that's included inside of there. There's wonderful. grabbing jQuery off of Google CDN, as well as a fallback method if Google somehow goes down or you don't have a connection to Google, and then also things like the asynchronous Google Analytics. Instead of using the default Google Analytics script, so you can use that there. And that's just all in the basic markup. And then inside the styles, they've got the Eric Myers Reset Reloaded, plus the HTML5 baseline, which is just... basically, it takes all of the HTML5 tags and sets them to a display of block, because by default in browsers, except IE, or IE before IE9, they all end up as inline tags. So this just sets them up so that they're block as you would expect. And then it lists these things out. And the best part is that it comes with comments. So every time there's something that you're not really sure of, or it seems kind of bizarre looking, there's almost always a comment to go along that says, okay, here's the blog post that explains why this is a great idea. And I guess for me, the thing that I love is, you know, I've been, you know, following a lot of these people doing a lot of these, you know, with these great ideas, and I've implemented them, you know, in some places kind of as I've learned them. But whenever I'm starting a new site, you know, I have my, you know, my basic setup, my basic markup. But then when I go and like, okay, what am I actually going to do here? I'm like, okay, need to grab my reset. I need to do this and that. And instead of starting from, okay, here are all the things, now what do I need? Like, here are all the best practices. I just want these, and pulling away the stuff that I don't need. I was trying to just add to it and like look at my old sites to see, okay, what did I do here? And now I just basically have everything. And if I wanted to make use of all this stuff, I certainly can. And the best part is that he's got it up on GitHub. When I say he, I mean Paul Irish. He's got it up on GitHub, and you can just basically send pull requests if you've got like what you think is a great idea. So you just, you know, clone his repository, make your changes, add in whatever thing you think should be a default for people when they're working on new HTML5 apps, and you know, if if he thinks it's reasonable, then he'll go ahead and update that, and it'll, you know, update it on the site, and these, you know, great ideas can now kind of be set all in one place. I think that we should also mention that there is another one out there called HTML5 Reset, which came out, I believe, the same day. It preempted Boilerplate a little bit. I've looked at that. It feels very similar. Just looking at them both, I should probably go through and compare them exactly. But I will say that I am pulled a little more because I happen to, I think, follow Paul Irish more closely. And so I, you know, obviously like to see what he's working on. And the site for Boilerplate, I think, is cuter than
Reset. Yes,
so,
certainly.
So that's what I go for.
Yeah, no, it's, I believe HTML5 Reset is off of the great site HTML5 Doctor, which, if you aren't following HTML5 Doctor and you're interested in this stuff, I highly recommend it.
Right.
It's a great, great site. And yeah, when I saw Boilerplate, I thought it was awesome, mainly because they put all the source on the homepage, and mm-hmm. so you can just view the homepage and all of a sudden pick up a bunch of tricks that you may or may not have known existed. You know, there's a bunch of brilliant stuff in there. So I love it, and I download it now, and I reference it pretty much with every new project I create. What I do, you and I are both students, Peter. So as a person that feels like I understand the value in having something like this, and picking from it what you need, and taking out any fluff, as an instructor, it terrifies me because there's already a tendency with students to, if there's anything that's kind of pre-baked, they throw in everything but the kitchen sink because they don't know yet how to kind of vet the features.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff in here that for a lot of sites you don't need. This is and I think they even admit it that this is it's not a framework. It's not meant to prescribe a philosophy of development. It's just a bunch of tricks to get you started quickly. And with that, when I download it, I have never used the whole thing. I only use what makes sense. And so if you are someone who has a tendency to perhaps make use of a lot of pre-built libraries or plugins and things, I urge you to try this, and I with the same amount of intensity and veracity, I also urge you to take the time to read the commented version and really decide which parts of it are relevant to your project, because this has the potential to really help your users and really accommodate their different user agents, accommodate better caching, so you're not always making them re-download every asset. But that will only go so far as you aren't making them download a bunch of useless crap because you didn't do your homework and remove the stuff that isn't relevant to your project. So it is, and I actually think that the HTML5 Reset style sheet is actually a better choice if you're working on a very simple page, because you know, the Boilerplate has all sorts of stuff for JavaScript libraries, as you mentioned, for old browser fallbacks, for rotations when you're on like an iPad or some device with a gyroscope, mobile style sheets, etc., etc. And these are things that if you're doing a little microsite or doing a quick project, probably aren't going to be terribly relevant to you. And the HTML5 Reset style sheet, meanwhile, is pretty much an analog of Eric Meyer's classic CSS Reset, with just a few minimal additions to make sure, as you mentioned before, that new tags have the correct block styles, etc. And so I think that these are two tools that, while they can replace one another, definitely look at the scope of your project and decide, is this something where I can just normalize the CSS styles and be okay? Or is this a project that's worthy of the Boilerplate awesomeness, and also taking the time to make sure that you really understand what's going on before you sort of have an avalanche of styles and foundational things that you're dropping on your user and the download speed of your site.
And I think we might need to clarify, because this was, I think I actually had one idea about HTML5 Reset, and you pointed out the other one. So if you actually just Google HTML5 Reset, this is kind of hilarious. So the HTML5 Doctor Reset Style Sheet does come up, but turns out that The HTML5 reset.org, which appears to have a very similar name, is actually, it was the one that I was thinking of.
Okay.
But I completely agree with you that these things, yes, if you, all you're looking especially is to start standardizing your styles, like I think anyone out there really should always be using a reset. Like unless you're really trying to keep the size of your code down and you know the few K of a reset is going to hurt things, if you don't want to go absolutely crazy because of IE and the various bizarre default settings, yeah, a browser reset or a CSS reset is a great idea. But yeah, so html5reset.org and html5reset as Google do turn up both the different things, which is really funny. And HTML5, I was just looking over it, and yes, I definitely like the boilerplate site a lot better. There's also a few more things or a few different things inside of a reset that I myself wouldn't use, whereas I would use more of what's provided in baseline. So that's probably a better reason for me to use it. But yeah.
Still
definitely exciting stuff to come
and
out.
If you are a designer like us and you are excited, Peter, I don't think that you have gotten a copy of this yet, so I apologize. But I recently it took a while to arrive, and a book apart has been very upfront with the shipping problems they've had, and they're really sweet. If you ask them, you know, hey, where's my book? Their customer service is awesome, so I am not. It's totally worth dealing with those shipping issues at first. I got my copy of HTML5 for Web Designers, and if you're familiar with this publication, it's pretty cool because it's the first release from the new publishing arm of the same folks who put on A List Apart and An Event Apart. And this release, the goal of it, it's a very thin book. I think it's something like 80-something. Yeah, it's 87, maybe just shy of 90 pages long. And you can read it in one sitting. I read it before I went to bed one night in probably about 40 minutes or so. And that's the goal. At the beginning of it, they basically say they want to create publications where you, as a web designer with a busy life, can be maybe in transit or something like that. You can quickly read a volume, you can gain that understanding, and then you can actually start applying it. And I really have to say that the title absolutely lives up to that promise. HTML5 can be incredibly perplexing. The reason being is that it's so loose and the tags, while borrowing from vernacular that's really common in CSS already, are very broad, and sometimes it can be hard to grep. You know, when do I use an article tag versus a section tag? You know, stuff like that. You know, there's header and footer tags, which sound like, you know, okay, great, I have, and nav to some extent as well, where, okay, great, I have divs that I usually name like an ID of header, footer, nav, but that's not technically exactly how those tags are supposed to function. So this is a great volume for the semantic parts of HTML5, for the new form elements, to just really, really quickly refresh yourself, figure out what those elements are truly for, where their strengths and where their pitfalls are. And also, I just have to say that the book is really, really funny. And I normally wouldn't say this about a tech volume, but I actually did laugh out loud multiple times. It's written by Jeremy Keith, who's a very prominent web developer, standards-based web developer. And my favorite part is probably when he's detailing the new color form input. Uh-huh. There's going to be a native color input, but the only browser that has implemented it so far is Opera, and it's really ugly. And I'm sorry, this was the date picker, not the color picker. But suffice to say, it's an ugly date picker. And he actually, you know, so he shows a screenshot of it, and it's got the little caption, and the caption says, you know, the date picker element in Opera made with their patented ugly stick technology. And so it's really entertaining, and they did a good job. So I know that it might seem counterintuitive. I don't actually buy many paper books for technical references because it seems like an odd translation to be flipping through paper and have to translate it to the screen. And I know that they will soon be releasing it in ebook format, but I do have to say that it's got a nice form factor, and I honestly would highly recommend it. I didn't feel like I was writing good HTML5 until I picked up this volume. So it's a great, great resource for anyone looking to put it to use. And it's written for designers. It's not super technical. It won't get into the Canvas drawing API or any of the like JavaScript craziness. It just tells you, here's what you can start using now. Go play, basically.
Well, that's very cool to hear. Yeah, I mean, I think I've already, on some projects we've started working on with HTML5, I think some of your insight has already come through, some things that we've talked back and forth about, especially how to use articles and where those things go. So I can understand that. Plus, it is funny. I was looking through, and the small tag actually has some semantic value now by removing, I believe they removed the big tag. I believe that's what the big tag in HTML4, which of course big and small, it just sounds like you're modifying presentation. But now that they've gotten rid of the big tag, which I was not aware of and checked up after we had talked, now small can really mean what everyone thinks of, you know, the small text. And so, you know, legalese and various things. So that's definitely, like, it's exciting to see that something besides just B and I was kind of morphed into something semantic. I still don't think that B and I are semantic, but, you know, I can understand why they want to leave them there for browser support.
Certainly. And there are other examples, too. You know, for example, menu is an old tag. I honestly do not remember what it was originally for, but it's been around a while. And there's going to be some exciting web app uses for that in the future. And so it's just, it does... I'm going to be honest, as a standards-minded person, as someone who really enjoyed the sort of fascistic strictness of XHTML, I think you and I agree that HTML5 tastes a little funny at first, with how loose it is and how forgiving it is. But I do have to say that this philosophy they have of, okay, it kind of reminds me of that saying with photographers where they say the best camera you have is the one you have with you. And what I realized is the best web language we can have is the one that our users can actually experience. Mm-hmm. And I feel like XHTML2 was probably the language you and I want, and HTML5 is the language you and I need. So people with real web browsers that exist today can actually start using our experiences immediately. Mm-hmm. And for that, I actually could not be more optimistic. I don't think it's going to usher in as many strictly minded, really well-formed markup gurus as the last generation of XHTML did, but I think it will maybe snap people out of the box of thinking those arguments are a religious war, and instead really shine the spotlight on the capabilities and no longer solely the principle of it and what might be if we all pull our head out, basically.
Yeah, I think the exciting part is that after everyone got over, you know, the idea of XHTML dying, when people actually looked at the spec and it's like, oh, you can do things with, you know, with self-closing tags. Basically, you can do things that are well-formed XML if you'd like. You don't have to be that strict. And the nice thing is that if you happen to be working with someone who doesn't want to do that, you can mix those styles. And as long as, you know, it doesn't, like, insult you, it's still going to validate. You know, it's still going to work. And as well as, you know, if you are maybe working on a larger project, if you want to convert people over, then they can be, you know, using the old style. You can be using the new one. But then if you convince them, like, hey, maybe self-closing tags do make a little more sense, or maybe you just, now maybe you can just change their, you know, their aesthetic, make people think they look sexy, and then they can change it and you're all right. I think it, even though before it was really just a doc type and a validator, now it's like those things are removed. You get to use the same doc type, the same validator, and you can just change your style if that's what you feel like. And
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That's definitely exciting stuff.
And speaking of versatility in web design, we've got to talk about the same way that IE9 really made it a great couple of months for HTML5. Google really stepped up and basically made it possible for us to actually start using for free some legally licensed web fonts with their new web font directory. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, this is a huge topic. I think when they announced it, and it was like, you know, they come into the space with, I think, like something like 20 fonts. They're reasonably good looking, and I mean, they generate the CSS for you right there. You just include a link to it. Like, it could not be simpler. I've brought this up in class when they announced it, and I've talked to people. I mean, I've got tons of people using it, tons of people experiencing, you know, fonts embedding great or better fonts than what we've had in a long time, and it's, you know, just as simple as can be. I think it's a great thing.
And what's wonderful about it is that there's no royalties, as we said before. It's all delivered via Google's super fast network of servers and stuff, so it's very reliable. Because there's no security key or account or anything like that, you can just grab it. It's really easy to locally test. It's not just them making the means of grabbing the fonts open. They've actually open sourced all of the typefaces. So if you want to use them in your design comps, if you want to use them in your identity guidelines, you can grab them for that too. And they've essentially created just this really, extensible, accessible cadre of typefaces that you can now use everywhere. And it's so nice to know. You know, when I'm designing a comp, you know, if I go to, say, use, like, Verdana or something like that, I now go, oh, wait, what about, you know, Cantarell, or what about Malengo or Droid Sans or Noble and all of these. And that's just so freeing, and it's really great. You know, I used to have to teach it used to take a while to teach students, you know, how to use new fonts. I remember when I was showing them Cypher and Kufon, and that was basically it. And I was like, okay, there's this font face thing, but it's not. And then later I got to show them Font Squirrel, but it always came up with that huge asterisk of well, yeah, but it might be illegal, so be really careful and do your homework. And, you know, earlier this year we started to see so this whole web fonts, I don't know if I should call it a movement, but there's definitely been a trend, was kicked off really by Typekit, which is there's a free version of it, but it's mostly a professional service where you subscribe to a library of typefaces. And I do have a subscription to it. I have the portfolio subscription. It's a great service. The only kind of Kool-Aid you have to drink that you have to get used to is the idea that, you know, even though you've got all these great fonts, and they recently added the Adobe family of fonts, which is just incredible now to have access to stuff like Garamond and Myriad and all this stuff, and News Gothic. And so it's a terrific service. I love it. And it's really easy and it's really intuitive, but it always feels just a little odd to know that if you don't pay up, you won't have access to those typefaces again. And I know it's always been a slight concern of mine that it relies on JavaScript. So it won't work without JavaScript. If they don't have JavaScript enabled, you're pretty much hosed. And so what's great about Google is that they collaborated with Typekit and used their sort of what they had developed in order for, like, good font delivery and everything like that to make a version that works solely with CSS, but then to also develop a Google API, so you can load it through the Google JavaScript API loader, so it's super quick. Their web font loader API, and what's wonderful about this is that it works for Google fonts, but it also works for Typekit fonts, and if you use one of the bigger Typekit competitors is Fonts Live from Ascender, and you can use it as well. And it's incredible that I really admire Google and Typekit for making something that was open like that, that you could use for everything. And what's wonderful now is that if you are someone who wants to use some Typekit fonts or some Google fonts, you can use one JavaScript library to really fine-tune how you're loading those. So Typekit has a great interface by itself for controlling the styles you're loading and everything, but if you are a JavaScript junkie and you want some fine-tuned control, the Web Font Loader API can make sure that you are loading only the families you want. You can control. Apparently, it also has some built-in stuff to help reconcile the font flicker that may occur when you're loading stuff via font face. It does some smart stuff to make everything conform to the way that Firefox loads it, which is apparently the preferred way for loading typefaces, according to typographic junkies. And again, it lets you. It's definitely the best way to go if you want to use one of the Google typefaces in conjunction with a Typekit font, because you don't have to include two separate libraries now. You simply include your Typekit kit ID variety when you're loading those font families, and you can control it all from one unified interface. And so it's really a terrific API because, you know me, I'm a fan of layers of functionality. At the very least, you can pick out, that's a cool font, include the style sheet, and boom, you can use it like you would Arial. But right. if you want really fine-tuned control and you want to really spread out, they've also got that great Web Font Loader API. And while I would love to see web fonts move to a place where we can really use any old font we want and we figure out the legalities of it, and there's at least a process in place for, I want to use font A, let me use it, instead of kind of this cart before the horse mentality that we have right now where you have to look at which fonts you are allowed to use based on your platform. It's still such a major step in the right direction. And if you haven't used one of these services yet, I implore you to do so. You will find it tremendously freeing after so many years I love Verdana in Georgia as much as the next guy, but sometimes you just need a new typeface.
Indeed. Yeah, this was a new thing that, I mean, it was a new thing. Let's see, I think I was definitely focused on the CSS approach before you had mentioned this. And I didn't know that, I knew they collaborated with Typekit, but I didn't realize that they had created like a meta font include basically. And what was really exciting was that they mentioned that right there about using things from Typekit or Ascender. And then the idea that you can also pass it a URL to a style sheet from another web font provider, assuming they obviously load up style sheets like Google is imagining they will, but assuming that this other font provider does do that, you can still use the same API, and you get it on the Google CDN. Like, you just get everything, it seems like, for free.
Well, what's even cooler is that the Web Font Loader also provides you with callbacks. So let's say you are... So here's a cool scenario for you. This is going to get uber geeky for a second, but hold on, strap in. So let's say that you are just a real stickler where I don't want you seeing my headlines if they aren't in Droid Sans. Mm-hmm. There are callbacks if you use the Web Font Loader. You know, obviously they'll need JavaScript enabled, but you could, let's say, just as an example, you could do a coupon solution with Droid Sans, and you could use the I believe it's the inactive callback, or you can do font inactive for a specific font. Mm-hmm. And if that font fails to load or the browser just doesn't support font face, you can put whatever JavaScript function you want in there. And so you could theoretically, if font face isn't available, still load Droid Sans through a library like Coupon or Cipher. Gotcha. And so it just really makes it a much richer development experience. But like I said, that can be really scary to the average web developer. Sure. So at the very least, you can just use it as a style sheet that you include like any other style sheet, and you can not worry about it. But if you're someone like me or you, where we get pretty anal retentive about making sure that the experience is really predictable, it's just wonderful to have all those tools and to have it be out there in the open and on Google code. I just could not be more excited right now for typography on the web. I wish I was teaching the internet text class again right now, because it would be so much more of an optimistic experience than it was last time I taught it.
Yeah, it seems like you could start off with custom fonts really early on instead of, you know, further down the line.
Exactly. Yeah. It's great. Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, no, that's very cool, and it's I must say that I learned something, so that's exciting.
Well, in this, I know we're going out of order on our outline here, but sure. Outlines are made to be broken, but before we move on, I know we want to, later on we're going to be following up on the Flash on Android issue and some issue. The Flash on Android debacle. Progress on that. But before we move on to that, since we're already on the topic of HTML5 and CSS3, I wanted to talk a little bit about... I know it's not too timely. It would have been better if we would have recorded podcasts more often and we could have discussed the potential of the 10K apart contest, because entries are now no longer able to be submitted. But there's some cool stuff in there. So... Peter, just to give my voice a rest, do you want to explain what the gist of 10K apart is?
Sure, yeah. So this was an exciting thing put on by a list apart, as we've been, I guess, talking about this entire time. It's basically just a contest to see, I would call it a contest to see who could put together a great HTML5 app that utilizes, I mean, the idea would be that it utilizes new elements of HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript in the browser, and you basically want to wrap something up in less than 10K, which, as it turns out, is actually pretty small, and you upload it here, and everyone votes on it. I think you can give a 5-star rating is basically how you can kind of decide. You don't have to sign up or anything. You can just go vote for whatever you want. And then there's prizes. I think there's the one grand prize is you get to go to an Event-A-Part event, which is quite the deal. And I think $3,000 in a Visa cash card, which shocks me that it's that large. And, of course, an a copy of HTML5 for web designers. And then there's a few more prizes and other things for people after that. And I think it was open for maybe like 45 days, or at least maybe that's when I heard about it. So it was open for a while, and I think they had something like 367 entries got put up there, which it's been really fun to, you know, just day in, day out, just come back and see kind of what people were doing from the, you know, from, I don't want to say the mundane, but some like exciting things with CSS that you just couldn't do, and you certainly couldn't do in 10K that you can do now, to other things like utilizing the canvas tag to implement some, I think someone has a 3D engine that was implemented in less than 10K. I believe it's being rated pretty high currently. But, you know, I think you could fly around a ship, which is fairly basic. But then there was this one called Surf by Osmosis, put together by this guy I know, that was a pretty fun one where you get a basically set the amount of time that you have for free, and it culls this information, you know, the pertinent information at the time from, I think, things like trending topics on Twitter and stuff. So that was pretty fun. I've definitely voted that up, and I think that if you want to talk about it as the author, I think you definitely should.
Absolutely. So I wrote Surf by Osmosis, and you can see it if you go to sticka.us/10k. I thought this was a really fun idea for a contest, and I had never attempted to write an app in less than 10K before, and I wanted to play with a few different things. I wanted to play with, this one's really mundane, and it's really not specific to any new browser technologies, but I've always felt uncomfortable developing for timed events. I don't know why. It's just timeouts and intervals and things of that sort. That when you put in that dimension of time, I always felt not very grounded. So when I was trying to think of ideas, I thought it'd be really cool if I could come up with something simple to wrap my head around this idea of time-based events and how to manage those and make sure that multiple events don't fire and all that stuff. It's something that I think a lot of developers find pretty simple, but what can I say? It's just something challenging for my brain, so I wanted to figure it out. And then I wanted to play with Canvas, and other than that, I just wanted to have fun. And it's a really challenging project. I know that this isn't the first time they've done it, so if they do it again, I encourage people to try it out because it's a lot of fun. I used jQuery. I used Typekit. The typeface I used, and I always forget what it's called. I think it's Cocon Web Pro. And I picked it because Osmosis felt like it should be a squishy name, and it looks a little squishy. And without being like offensively expressive, I suppose. Then I use the Google Ajax Feed API, which, again, Google APIs are great because you pick only the features you need, and they're usually really robust and really well documented. And then it has a little timer that's animated via Canvas, and anyone who's spent some time farting around the Mozilla developer community probably recognizes this is a simplified and tweaked version of, they have a wonderful animated clock example that was very useful for me for understanding. It can be really perplexing working with rotating the drawing space in the Canvas tool. And so there was definitely a few tear your hair out moments trying to get that to work. But ultimately, it was really rewarding. And what's really beautiful, even if you don't do it for a contest, what's really beautiful about the 10KB limit is that it really forces you to distill down exactly what your app needs to run. So I'll be blogging about this later, and by the time we publish this podcast, the post may already be up. But what I found was my favorite version of this app is the final version, even though the final version is full of compromises, because I finished the app and I could not get it under 12KB to save my life. I couldn't. And the things that were really bulking it up were superfluous things. Like, I was using a lot of gradients. And if you've used CSS3 gradients right now, WebKit and Mozilla have are both rather verbose, and they're completely different. I know students who have taken my class have heard me rant about how awful I think the WebKit gradient syntax is, so I'm very relieved to hear. I believe last I heard the W3C is going to adopt the Mozilla method as their recommendation, and I could not be happier because Mozilla, you know, they write the gradient stops in the correct order, and they don't make up new ways of specifying units, which the WebKit method does. But I digress. And box shadows and things. And in having to remove those, there was some more dimension on the watch before. And having to remove those, I all of a sudden, it went from being this very dimensional but kind of gray, drab site to this really flat but ultimately kind of peppy green site that I think I feel like is a complete accident. It was completely because I needed to take all those features out. But the result, and this is a lesson that I'm going to carry on to my other projects, the result is perhaps more pure, and it kind of has this, you know, I know I'm talking about my own app here, right, but it feels more to me like it wants to go, like the green is urging you forward, whereas before the gray felt sort of sedentary. And so basically what I'm trying to say, it's a ton of fun. And even if you're not doing it for a contest, if you have a little app idea, and the little ideas are the best, you know, try spending a Saturday just making one up. It's some of the most fun I've had in a while, making an application. But yeah, there's some great other ones. And there was one in particular, I'm having trouble finding it now, because for whatever reason, I have a feeling, a few people have told me that the voting system, the rating system on this site is kind of questionable, and they've told me that it's super easy to vote multiple times, which means that it's probably really easy to game the system. So you can find this because there's a few apps that are pretty cool, but have like thousands more votes than any other app, and maybe not that many more comments. And you can also tell occasionally that I think there are bots that are giving 1-star reviews to other apps as well. Oh, so, wow. So it'll be interesting to figure out how they're going to be doing the viewer's choice, because I'm not saying that people are necessarily doing that. There could be people that are just really passionate, but some of my favorite apps, which I voted up, aren't really buried down below apps that are, while good, maybe not quite as interesting. And one of my favorites is actually one called Inspired by and I apologize if someone's listening and knows that I'm butchering the name, but I believe his name is Curtis Jurgensen. And you can find that if you're on the site. It's entry 370. But it's a really simple image searching app, and it just searches Flickr and a few others, and I think like Dribbble and some stuff. And all you do is you put in some sort of search term. It's basically like an inspiration hunting site. It reminds me a little of like a searchable, live version of kind of like Chris Kalani's Yay Everyday, and then it's just giving you some info. But I think it's really attractive for 10. It doesn't look like a 10K site at first glance. It just looks like a really cool minimal site. And that's the sort of stuff that I found in this that's just super simple, but really visually appealing, and just kind of just clever little implementations. And who knows? I mean, this seems a lot faster if you were trying to find an image really quick than, say, even like a Google image search or something. So I could see this being expanded into a cool inspirational tool. So that's just one example, but there's a bunch of cool stuff there. Go look through the gallery. There's for some reason a proliferation of 3D canvas-based aquariums, which is an odd thing that I think there's like three. Wow. But there's a really great variety, and I'm just my app at one point was the second highest rated. It has since fallen down to 3.something-something, but I'm still humbled by the amount of positive votes, and I know that Rick Tarosi tweeted about it for Silicon Florist and stuff like that. And so for everyone who has seen my tweets and has voted it up and paid attention to it, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I've had a few people suggest that I should expand it and make it a full-fledged, a more than 10K app. and continue letting me know if you'd be interested in that, because I would be interested in developing it some more. So. Very anyway, cool. End plug, but it's a really cool contest, and I'm excited to see who the esteemed judges pick out.
Yeah, I think it'll be very exciting to see what happens there. I will say that I think one of the very early ones, I'm trying to go grab the number. Yeah, entry 83, it's an app called Sinuous. It's basically just a A canvas app where you have a series of dots that are coming down towards you, and red dots, and you are controlling this line. And you have to, wherever your mouse cursor goes, this line will kind of follow you, but the trouble is that it stays where it was for a while, and it follows the curvature of your mouse, and then it finally, like, sucks back up into your cursor. And at any time, if a red dot hits any of the line, then you lose. And it actually turns out to be this addictive thing that I'm sad, much like yours is now, like, I think it's right around where yours is in the ratings, and it just seems like, man, it just seems like a quality app. So I am wondering, it'll be interesting to take a look and see if more recent uploads got higher votes or somehow got higher ratings. I'm not sure, but that'll be definitely interesting to follow.
Well, I'm noticing now, it looks as if ratings are now closed, because I'm noticing that you can no longer click. But yeah, it will be interesting. I just hope that someone over at 10K Apart notices that people can vote as many times as they want. So apps like Sinuous, which I'm playing now, is super addictive. It's great. And apparently it has iPad and iPhone compatibility, and it's only 6.9 KB. So,
wow.
Yeah. So this stuff is seriously impressive. So don't necessarily sort by highest rating. Just hop through. There's some great stuff in there. It's really cool.
Very
but
cool.
Well, so we've talked a lot about HTML5 and CSS3. This should really be the Friends Electric HTML5 podcast sometimes, I swear. But
yeah.
What can I say? That's where things are happening right now. There's a lot of exciting stuff. But let's talk about something other than HTML5, though.
Yeah,
Peter.
Let's talk about the thing that gets us in trouble in the comments. So I've got to say, based on the first two that we did, I must say I was humbled by some of the comments that we got, and I also appreciated some of the dialogue. Someone linked to basically said they couldn't agree with anything we said in the podcast, and which I, you know, obviously love to hear, and was talking about how this was before Flash 10, or let's see, the Flash Player came out for the Nexus 1, basically before it came out with the Android Froyo update 2.2. And so at the time, the comments that I've made, it seemed at the time that there was really nothing that developers could do without, you know, recompiling their apps to get apps running on touch-based devices. Like, basically things using your hover navigation, your if you have to, you know, drag or move your mouse. It seemed at the time, and I would say at the time I thought I was right, that was like necessary. But it turns out that through some stuff that Lee Brimelow put up and was actually linked to in the comments for our first episode, as well as the actual release of the product, it showed that they were able to do something similar that Apple did with Safari, where they basically faked mouse down, mouse up, and hover events and styles just using the normal tap events of a touchscreen. And so Lee Brimelow has a video up that shows a lot of things running on a tablet, so not exactly running on Android or a mobile device, but running on a tablet, and it was basically working. Like, there was a car game where you could control just by dragging your finger, and that was working without recompiling the game or anything like that, with an updated build of Flash or whatever. And so I must say that definitely changed my mind, and I kind of had to recalculate exactly what my thoughts were on this topic. And so I kind of decided to hold back and just say that basically what this means is that they're going to run into similar problems that Safari runs into, a mobile Safari, as well as, you know, every mobile browser on a touchscreen. So that would be drag and drop by default isn't going to work. Those you have to implement those things with new events, which is basically, I mean, that's a problem that happens in every browser. I think that's a problem that hopefully we'll see resolved in some of our frameworks like YUI and jQuery. I know that you can automatically change those things now, and I'm sure that they'll have fixes for them in the future, but it would be nice if it were automatically handled with an upgrade to the library. At any rate, I think that that's kind of where my opinion stands now, that, you know, they still have some issues, but basically they've, I think, resolved it as well as Apple did with a mobile Safari when that came out, as far as, like, you know, dragging and hovering is concerned. But I was excited to see a 2.2 come out with Flash running on it. I have a friend at work who has a Nexus 1, and he was nice enough to let me play around with it. And I must say, I didn't play with it a too huge amount, but based on my experience with it, it was definitely not as performant as I would have liked. I was watching a Yahoo, let's see, I used the Yahoo Movie Trailer app, which does use a hover-based interface, and I was running on Wi-Fi, and the Wi-Fi that we have at work is quite speedy, so I would expect that to be basically running as well as you can. I know that 2.2 has now come out for the Droid, which runs, I believe it runs a 600 megahertz processor, as opposed to Nexus One's 1 gigahertz processor. This is getting very geeky, I understand. Just want to specify all these things. And so, from what I can tell, the Nexus One, you know, for people who are, you know, running the default software on, you know, like unmodified hardware, I believe that this is like the Nexus One is the fastest way that you can run it. And in my experience, the UI was interesting to say the least. So they have a hover-based UI where if you tap, you do get that hover event. The trouble is that if you tap, you have to tap again to use the Yahoo Movies trailer like scrubber and the play pause button to a point where I actually couldn't tap fast enough to utilize those things. So we kind of thought that was odd. So it was interesting because...
So, like, you couldn't even do, like, a quick double tap to kind of do, like, hover immediately followed by click. It would just immediately disregard the hover action and then fire the click.
Right, or at least that's what my experience with it was. Now, I tried to do it as fast as I could. It could just be that I am just terrible at this. So, you know, totally could be my fault,
Well, no, it stands to reason that if you can't do it, there's probably other people out there
right,
who can't.
Right,
do
then,
it.
Yeah. So I think, overall, I think that it was exciting to see that as far as, while Flash wasn't as performant as I would want it to be, and so I can still see Steve Jobs' point. He probably, like, if this were the experience of this first version of, essentially the Flash plugin running on mobile, it runs like this, I can see why he, you know, still wouldn't want it on there. But I can see that if things continue to improve, and knowing that Android is, since it's based on such a large stack, it has such a large technology stack underneath of it, and it basically needs more power to run swiftly, I think that these phones are going to continue to improve. And so I'm definitely looking forward to hardware enhancements that are going to come out of Android. So I guess I can say that I still have hope for Flash on, you know, on mobile, and I find it. It will be interesting, especially if people can get a large following of users who are using, you know, devices that can actually do it. So, you know, Droid devices at this point, it's either the Droid, the Motorola Droid, or the, Motorola Droid, or the Nexus One. I'm not sure about the Droid X. I know that just came out. Maybe that ships with the right software. I'm not sure. But anyway, you know, there's a few things now. Hopefully it expands. And I can say that I still like Flash, and I hope that there's a future there, but I can definitely say that I don't think Steve Jobs is going to relent, in my opinion.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. Well, what's a little worrisome to me, and I know I'm just inviting more comment rage,
sure.
So I'm just going to say that up front. Please direct your hateful comments toward me. the original iPhone came out in what, mid-2007 or something
so,
like
yeah.
that. It was announced at the beginning at 2007. I don't know when the first Android device came out, but it came out a little ways beyond that. So we're talking this platform that as soon as you and I saw it, even before there was an app store, any designer or developer is thinking, great, what can I do with this sort of platform? So we're seeing 3 years later, you know, I know that people will argue it's the first version.
Right.
Right. And, some of the problems, I've heard about the problems with the finger capture, how if you zoom in or if you full screen or something like that, it's, you can't zoom out without closing the browser and all this stuff. These are things that can be fixed. But they've had 3 years, to come up with the sort of mobile paradigm. And so my question is this, and you and I we have developed in Flash and we enjoy Flash for its capabilities, and I am not a Flash hater. I think the industry needs Flash in order to push it along, because as much as I love standards are a bureaucracy, and like any other bureaucracy, it moves too slow to keep up with our ideas. That being said, what is the payoff for leveraging this platform for mobile, other than simply quickly porting your pre-existing desktop experiences to a mobile platform? Is there any advantage at this point for starting with Flash as part of your mobile strategy?
I would definitely say no. I think with CS5 coming out and with the... with Adobe CS5 when it was coming out and the idea that Flash was going to be able to compile down to run on the iPhone. I that is what I was thinking, like, okay, they can get something that compiles down to the iPhone. You know, they can get... Granted, people have to install apps, but, you know, that gives you a good reason to do that. When they... When that got taken away, when Apple said no to that, that's where I really started to... That's, I guess, where it really started me questioning how this can be your mobile endeavor. I think what the best place to use it now is if you already have something running on Flash, or you're, you know, that's your primary development motivation is Flash, or what you're typically delivering things in. I think that if you want to continue working in that and then basically just, you know, start on some mobile stuff to play around with it and give it some time and then maybe port things over, I think that would make sense. But as far as starting something specifically with the idea of mobile in mind, I can definitely say that starting with Flash is not where I would go.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a tough thing. But when you look at, you know, IE9 supporting Canvas, and you look at the really cool games that they're doing at 10K apart, and you look at the fact that a lot of these games that people are making, they're like, oh, and by the way, it works out of the box on your iPad and your iPhone. And for my web standards class, we recently had Jason Grigsby come in and speak. And he talked about a lot of different technologies, and he talked about the dominance of WebKit in the smartphone market and things like that. And it could have just been that presentation, but Flash didn't even seem to be on his radar. And so for me, it's 3 years into this sort of the mainstreaming of smartphones. And I know that especially in the U.S., we have an extremely iPhone-centric view of the smartphone market, right, when in fact... Android and BlackBerry are still huge forces, as are other Symbian's a huge force too. But you know, the question is, if we're this far along where we've got these established platforms, whether it be HTML5 with Canvas and stuff, which is going to be if it's not considered ubiquitous right now, it's going to be sooner rather than later. And, you know, the XHTML1 mobile profile is already pretty ubiquitous. You've got the walled gardens already. You've already got the iOS store. You've got the Android marketplace. You've got RIM's marketplace. You've got Windows Phone 7 coming out with their Silverlight-based SDK, where they will have that native support. You know, what is Flash's niche, and can it carve one out of the convenience factor of simply being able to say, well, if you go to this site... I put in a few mobile events, and I know that I'm not going to make any friends by saying that, but as a developer, I'm constantly looking, as a designer and developer, I'm constantly looking for what platform will allow me to reach the most eyeballs, or more specifically, will allow me to reach my audience. And until Flash can answer that for me beyond, well, you won't have to write it twice, I don't see how they're going to be dominant. I don't see how it's ever going to be more than a little feature asterisk that certain phones have that say, oh, and you don't have to download an app for this video now. You can just watch it. Assuming they have put some time into ironing out those hover features and stuff like that.
Yeah, I would have trouble disagreeing with you. I definitely think that as far as the people out there that I know that are working on Flash stuff, it would be curious. I'll put this out there now. I'm curious if we would be able to hear from them and you know, hear about maybe stuff that they're working on or hopes that they have for mobile. Right. I know that it before it's and I took part in it. It was this idea not so much of the viability of Flash as a platform, but just the possibility that it could even run. And I think now that we're past it even running, now we actually get to ask ourselves, like, you know, what is the viability of the platform? So I think as a standards web developer, you know, my passion being HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, I'm constantly looking for reasons and ways to implement things on Canvas. That's a current passion of mine. I completely understand that Flash running on your typical desktop browser is going to be a lot faster at doing a lot of the things that Canvas can do, and it's going to be able to do a lot more. Like you said, things, you know, organizations move slowly. So if you really want to implement something cool and exciting, you know, there's Flash. There's also, I'll put a plug in there for Silverlight. They've got some cool stuff going on in there. I'd still say Flash wins out, but there's some cool stuff there. But yeah, as far as mobile, it just seems like if you want to even if you just want to play around, doing HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript is just the way to go.
Absolutely. We should at some point have like a sort of mobile app development roundtable episode. Like, we should get folks like, you know, maybe I could twist Jason Grigsby's arm, or we could get Jeff Perry's, who's the award-winning Silverlight developer, mm-hmm. who is probably, I'd be shocked if he wasn't exploring this Windows Phone 7 stuff.
And, oh, yeah.
Maybe like Tim Sears, who did Robot Vision and Future Check. I know I'm name dropping right now, but these are all folks that are have great opinions, and so we should look into that. Maybe doing a cool episode to actually get it. We're still kind of tire kickers because I know that you've done design work for mobile apps and you mm-hmm. fiddled with this stuff, and I fiddled with it as well. But I think that, especially based on how impassioned the comments have been on this particular issue, I think it might be worthwhile in the future to kind of get the folks who put their money where their mouth is and get their opinions.
Absolutely. If we're name dropping, I don't know if this is going to give us anything, but maybe if Nevin Morgan would like to come on and talk about his experiences with PyGuy, maybe we'll just have to ping him and see what happens.
That would be pretty swell.
Very exciting. I think that's a great idea. I'll add that to the Google Doc of ideas.
Yes, our idea doc, if you will.
That sounds like a good idea.
Fantastic. So jQuery Mobile.
jQuery Mobile. This is an exciting thing. When I saw it first announced, I think I actually either saw it from John Resig's tweets or jQuery's tweets themselves. The idea that in the near future, we're going to have jQuery Mobile, which is going to give us something, as far as I can tell, it's going to be something like JQ Touch, which looks to still be an iPhone-specific kind of, I don't want to say app engine, but almost like an app framework, JavaScript-based web app framework. It looks like, from the screenshots and from what I read, jQuery Mobile is going to be like that, but for cross-platform, cross-devices. I mean, they have a crazy list. They have this insane grid. I know that they already had the support grid for regular jQuery about their the browsers that exist on the desktop, but if you haven't looked at all the browsers that exist on mobile, then you should definitely take a look at this list, because it is insane. So they have their A, B, I think they have A, B, C, and F ratings, and then all these different meanings for what the ratings actually mean. And so they're talking
about... We'll put this in the show notes, but the graph is at jQueryMobile.com/GBS. That's, you know, Gary Busey Super. GBS.
I must say that even I was taken aback with, especially like the number of Symbian platform. I mean, there's Symbian platform, Symbian UIK, Symbian S60. I mean, they have really done their work. Don't quote me on it exactly, but I've seen tweets from PPK about he was surprised that they took on this, you know, this mess of actually grading these browsers. So it's nice to see that the work is there. I watching an episode of jQuery, the jQuery podcast, and John Resig came on to talk about, you know, his hopes for the project, how long he was working on it, and so it's nice to see now that we have jQueryMobile.com. We've got it up there. We have the strategy, the goals all listed out, and the idea being that we might someday soon have the ability to develop cross-platform web apps in a way that doesn't take an insanely long time, which, as I've been tinkering with things, even with things like jQuery Touch, it still takes me a bit of time to get up and running. And so the idea that we'll have this, like, be able to use it, you know, on multiple projects, it'll continue to improve with versions, and if working with it is anything like working with jQuery, I think we can safely say that it'll revolutionize the way that mobile web apps work. So overall, I know that I feel like I'm like Leo Laporte. I'm just so excited for these things, and I'm so optimistic. Obviously, it could go terribly, things could go wrong, but I think based on John Resig's and the rest of the jQuery's team track record, I think this is going to be some exciting stuff.
Yeah, it looks really cool. I am really interested in seeing... do you know if they've posted any live demos? They've posted a lot of, like, comps and their strategy and all of that. And, of course, you know, John Resig and crew have a fantastic track record. But I'm really looking forward to seeing this thing, you know, actually on a device and see how it works.
Yeah, near as I can tell, they're still comp. So that episode of YayQuery, I'll try to find it and put it in the show notes. It wasn't that long ago, and I believe he said he'd been working on it for maybe the past year or so. So based on the complexity of it, I would imagine that it's still going to be a while before we see real live demos on it. I'm looking through the designs right now, and I'm curious to see. I guess I can't really tell if they look like they're running on devices. They look like they're just straight out of Photoshop or whatever they're using. But yeah, I think we should watch this and follow up in the future and kind of maybe have an episode to, or part of an episode to dissect these things and take a
Absolutely.
Look. Yeah, maybe it'll we can kind of frame this around. Maybe by the time we can get a quorum together of people to discuss mobile development, maybe this stuff will be that far along that we can discuss it.
One phenomenon that you and I, speaking of mobile, one thing, that's a great segue, wasn't it?
It was perfect.
I'm getting better at this. speaking of mobile, I sure do love Nutty Odie brand cereal. No, it keeps me going. No, we've both been noticing this phenomenon and this is something that is not new to any designer or developer who has procured a smartphone recently, which is that we're able to actually design and develop on the go, you know, in limited capacity often. But it's a new thing, and I've been having conversations with folks and realizing that this is really going to... we're edging toward that place where if your client calls you freaking out because there's some bug or something like that, you might actually be able to fix it on the train ride over to wherever you're going instead of having to drive into the office or VPN in or something like that. Peter, do you use any sort of like mobile tools? I know you have an iPhone and an iPad. I'm interested in what you're doing away from your sort of command center.
Yeah, interesting you ask. So I'm currently trying to get like the perfect setup, and it definitely hasn't existed. I feel like the real perfect setup would require, you know, an actual native iPhone and iPad universal app for me to get exactly what I want. But I've been doing as much as I can. So I think you and I have both used this Dropbox text editing app for the iPhone that just came out called Nebulous Notes. I guess it's universal, so it's for the iPhone and iPad. And this is great for things like if you have something that you're editing in Dropbox, you can just open it up, you can manage your folders from your iPhone or your iPad, and you can edit any text files that exist there. This is something that I really feel should be in the Dropbox app itself, but for quick editing of things, especially on, you know, projects where I have shared Dropbox folders with other people, I can just edit those things and they get it right there. So I think for like the quick one-off Dropbox-based stuff, that's what I use. Beyond that, there's a great app called FTP on the Go, and this app allows you to it saves connections, it saves FTP connections. You can easily, you know, log in, save your password so you don't have to manage all that stuff, and then go in and download any file that you want. I mean, a text file would be the obvious choice for editing. Download any file that you need to, edit it right there in the app itself, save it into a local cache, and then upload the file whenever you'd like back to wherever you'd like. That has actually come in handy for several things. When my son was born, I was in the hospital. I planned as much as I could. I had the time, I believe, set up correctly for when he would be born, because we had to have a scheduled medically necessary C-section. But the nice thing is that kind of fell into my scheduled life. So in this case, I was able to get everything ready. I basically knew when he was going to pop out. And so I had things set up that all I had to do was flip a bit. And basically start uploading to Flickr and some pictures of him, and our site, thewoolies.com, which at the time just had basically a stream of pictures and some information about when he was born. I was just able to go in there and upload a file that I'd already edited, and it would, you know, magically do its work there. And so it's already come in handy for those quick on-the-go things. I've used it for various other things for work and other projects, but I guess that's like my canonical example that I love to talk about. Yeah. Beyond that, I will say that what I'm currently working on now, there's another app. It's a great universal app. I think it's $9.99, but it's called ISSH. And so the notion is that you basically can either SSH, or they have a VNC viewer, which allows you to do like remote desktop type stuff, but with VNC clients. And so SSH by itself is just Basically, you get access to the command line of a remote computer. And so in this case, what I've actually found is that over the past year or so, I've developed a love for this text editor called Vim. So it originally was VI, and now they have VIM or Vim. Vim improved is what it's short for. And it's basically just this simple command line-based text editor. Well, I shouldn't say simple. It's complicated. It's very hard to use. It's almost stupid hard to use. But once you get into it, it's amazing what you can do with just the keyboard. And so what I've done is I've now moved a bunch of stuff. I currently have Dropbox on some shared hosting that I have SSH access to. So I can now edit files with syntax highlighting on my iPad using Vim through SSH, and I can actually edit things right there. And so the only thing that I'm missing, and what I really want in the perfect app, is the ability to preview things. So if I'm basically, I could live edit, now I can live edit everything. So if in a native app, I would want to be able to do HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, that'd be fine. But now with this solution, assuming I have an internet connection, assuming it's good enough to run SSH very well, I can actually edit any file, anytime, anywhere, and I get the syntax highlighting. I can do whatever I can do in a command line, I can get it right there. And then what I really want is to be able to preview without either closing my app, or if I wait long enough, I should be able to get the iOS 4 on my iPad. So what I'll be able to do is just have Safari open to some URL, and I'll just be able to double tap my home button and switch back and forth. So I'll have ISSH, which has already been updated for iOS 4 for persistent connections. And as soon as the iPad has that ability to keep that app open, I'll just be able to switch back and forth. And I'm really looking forward to this. I think a native app could give me this, or maybe something like combining that, where I have SSH so I can work remotely, but then I have maybe a web view right on the other side and it constantly refreshes. I'm not really sure, but I think there's definitely a space there. But as far as mobile development works for me, I could not be, I couldn't talk anymore about it, and I could not be more excited, but I'm looking for the perfect solution. So I'm always right. Open to hearing what other people do. So I'm curious what what your solutions are.
Well, your solution is way cooler than mine is. So the most indispensable app is a combination of the Dropbox, the official Dropbox app, and Nebulous Notes, especially as a designer, because it's really great. I am actually working on an iPhone project right now, and it's great being able to save out a comp in Dropbox and just open up my phone and be able to view it live on the screen there and see how it feels at the actual resolution and the form factor and everything. And then, of course, for development, since I have not set up SSH and all that stuff, maybe next time we get together, you're going to have to show me how you do that, because it sounds pretty cool. Nebulous Notes is really the only thing I have there. I also use pulling it up right now, the FTP on the Go app, which lets me tap into my servers and it too has a built-in text editor. Again, no syntax highlighting, but it's super nifty. And one of the things I love is that it automatically generates a backup whenever you make any file edits. So
that's true.
That is something I have occasionally been a little twitchy about, how easy it is to save a file on Nebulous Notes. I'm less twitchy because Dropbox is really great about storing revisions, but still, at first I was like, oh, crazy, it actually just saved what I did there. There's no going back now, that's the file. And unless you went into the Dropbox web UI, whereas FTP on the go always does, I think it's like .old or .back or something like that. And and then I also have, if you have a blog, the WordPress app is a must, especially for squashing spam and comment approval and stuff. And then I do twin-fisted sort of analytics app action, where I've got ego on one tile and then analytics on the other. And analytics is the super full-featured Google Analytics app. It does almost everything Google Analytics does, but Ego is the one I go to most often. It's updated more often. It's really simple. You just make tiles for every bit of analytics data you want to get. So Google Analytics, your Twitter accounts, Mint, I think it supports, not the finance app, the tracking app, a bunch of different ones, and it lets you see your traffic right then and there. So not nearly as exciting. I'm actually salivating a little at how cool using Vim and SSH and all that stuff sounds like it would be. That sounds like a real solution. But this is enough, too. I know I was telling you about I've been sick most of this week, and so I was sick when I had to submit that 10K app, but I was actually able to, because I was developing the app on Dropbox, I was and I was doing so in the public Dropbox folder where you can grab a URL and basically use it as an impromptu server. I was able to make a couple of quick edits in Nebulous Notes and then immediately view it in Safari. And since it's on my iPhone 4, I can get that multitasking, so I could just hop between the two of them. And,
Very cool.
Yeah, so it's really super. I think this sort of thing is only going to grow. It's a little disappointing to see that it hasn't come much farther. It must be, not being an iOS developer, there must be something really... I know that syntax highlighting is super tricky in web programming, and so I wonder if it's a bit tricky using the built-in form controls for Apple. Since they're so uniform, I bet that Apple doesn't take too kindly to having a live syntax highlighting or anything like that.
Yeah, I'd wonder that. I know there's a couple apps out there, and I've seen a couple apps, people working on things on like Dribbble and such, that look very tasty, but they certainly haven't come to be. I believe that there's probably a rumor, heck, I probably started it, about Coda possibly having an iPad version. And I definitely think that a solution like that will come, but it's been interesting to kind of bootstrap our own. I think now going forward, especially since I was completely in love with the idea of just doing HTML, CSS, and JavaScript natively, but now that I've gotten used to using things over SSH, I'm like, wow, this could really come in handy.
Nice.
I think this is definitely an area. I know I talked to some developers. I'm working with an iOS developer now, and I every time I mention it about developing on my iPad, he just like shudders and things like, oh, I would never do that. And so I think part of it is like, well, maybe with an external keyboard people could do it, but I just love the idea of being able to create a keyboard that is like specific to the application you're working with. Like, what if we were able to modify the keyboard so that what it showed, or you know, the things that maybe there you get in like an extra line of things that are visible, and it's all like the variables that you're working with in your current local scope, or like functions that you need to have access to rapidly, and you just tap it, it adds it in, and then it just like puts your cursor in there so you can start adding arguments. Like the idea that we had these old keyboards and the iPhone came along, and some people couldn't, you know, type on them as fast and all that, but we can do so much more with them now. I mean, we get automatic spelling correction. We get all this crazy stuff, and there's all that intelligence in there of like, okay, this is the only letter that could possibly match a word in my dictionary, so I'm going to give it more space. So if you happen to overshoot it because you're excited or typing too fast, you're still going to type the right thing. Like, that's exciting stuff that we just have never had. So I, myself, am excited to see what mobile development can really be. I'm not sure that it'll ever take over my 108-key keyboard and my, you know, I've got the Logitech Wave keyboard everywhere I go. I love this thing. But, you know, maybe with the right app, the killer app, this iPad and iPhone deal will really, really pan out.
Well, I think what I like about the and you know me, I am the most hardcore iPad skeptic.
Yes, that's true.
And really that, I believe, was a defense mechanism because of... you know, I love Apple, but their announcements have always had an air of hyperbole about them, but never more so. I mean, the iPad is really still, it's just a giant iPod Touch, and that's cool, and it's cool for that. Like, it's a more intimate experience. You can do more stuff with the screen real estate. It's a wonderful at-home device. It really feels like the most personal computer that you've ever had, but all of this thing about how it was magic and revolutionary and everything, when it is essentially a logical iteration of what they had already accomplished, definitely put my sensibilities, like, I think they found their threshold for how much of that I can tolerate before I start calling bull. And so, having played with several of them and everything, and I do plan on getting one, I'm going to wait till after the September 8th announcement to make sure that Apple's not going to drop any more crazy goodies. You know, I want to see if they announce an Apple TV. I'd love to see if that's something that's more worth more worthy of my dollars. But I'm sure some people are like, well, if it is such a personal computer, why do we have to nerd it up with like development tools and everything? And I don't think I don't think what you and I necessarily want is something that's going to replace our desktop machines, because let's face it, a physical keyboard and mouse are actually really good development tools. But I think what we want is that comfort in knowing that we're on vacation with your wife or my girlfriend, respectively speaking, of course. I don't think I'd be on vacation with your wife or you with my girlfriend, but unless it was like a group thing, that would be fun sometime. But And knowing that if we get that call that we all dread, the oh my god, it's exploding call, that we would be able to take out our sort of convenient, portable consumer device and have a means to fix that problem without disrupting the flow of our lives. And so it's going to be really exciting. And speaking of the disruption of our lives, nothing disrupts our weekends quite like conferences.
They do.
See? More segues. Yes,
well,
I'm
these
doing
are perfect.
It.
I'm loving these.
Awesome. Awesome. We should do an all segues episode where it's like one sentence topics followed by a segue. It'd be like, like a Steven Wright or a Mitch Hedberg.
extravaganza.
Yeah, exactly. But so are you going to WordCamp this year?
Yes, I'm planning on attending WordCamp, and I noticed, I believe it's, I haven't been following exactly, but I believe it's changed. I know, let's see, A. Hockley on Twitter was running it, and I always fail on his first name. But I'm not.
I think it's like Aaron.
Aaron, yes. I believe he might have, has it changed hands? I don't know. It's interesting to see kind of what's been going on there on the blog. At any rate, I'm excited. I know I have a former student who's giving a talk, so I'm very excited to see
Dominique.
What she has to say. Exactly, yeah. So that's, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that's very cool. I have not bought tickets yet because my schedule is still kind of in flux, and it might even be the weekend after or 2 weekends after. I'm going to be a speaker at Cyborg Camp, part of my attendance might hinge on whether or not I'm done with my presentation materials for Cyborg Camp in time. I might need the weekend. But no, we'll talk about Cyborg Camp in a second, but if I can go, I would love to, because first of all, this was the case last year, but this year, Matt Mullenweg, who's obviously the WordPress founder, and Jane Wells, who's the user experience lead at Automattic, are both going to be back. And if you haven't seen these two in particular speak, and Matt Mullenweg does great conversational roundtables, and he'll be doing another one of those. They're really great. These are such smart people, and they're so inspirational. And I know you and I have a tremendous admiration for WordPress because they've managed to take a very open, very community-based piece of software and not only maintain that sort of open source nature of it, that community nature of it, but also form a business out of it. You know, WordPress.com is a profitable business, and not just profitable, but extremely useful for folks who, you know, don't have the time to deploy WordPress to their own servers or shared hosting or what have you, or want the service of having someone to think about that for them. And so it's a really unique event because it's sort of this collision of folks like you and I who see WordPress as a platform. And a development platform, I should say, and folks who see it as software, as I love to write here. And truth be told, most of the people at the conference are a little bit of both. So so if you can go, listeners, not you, Peter, you're going, but if you can go, you should go. And it's really cool that Dominique's going to be there. I've only met her. I did not get to teach her while she was still. I believe she's graduated now, but I guest spoke in a class she was in, and I've interacted with her on Twitter, and she's a smart cookie, so it should be really fun.
Yeah, it's exciting. Actually, you know, don't quote me on this, but she might actually be graduating very soon, and I believe the end of the term is right around. I should know this because I'm teaching this term at the Art Institute. I believe that it's happening right then, so she might be speaking and graduating very much at the same time, so it'll be very fun to watch what she does. So
that'll be a hell of a week for her, yes. She'll be very tired, but
very
it should
exciting.
Be rewarding.
Yeah, and so then, I guess you had mentioned it before, but I would also, I'm planning on attending, I'm not even sure if tickets are available, but they probably are. But I'm planning on going to Cyborg Camp, and I hear that you're a speaker there.
Yes, Cyborg Camp is the weekend. I believe it's October 2nd is the weekend. And tickets are on sale right now.
Cool.
And they're only $10 until September 24th. And then they'll rise up to 15. But what's cool about CyberCamp is it's a very intimate conference, so there's only 120 heads. So it will never be bigger than that. And I went to the inaugural one in Portland in 2008. Mm-hmm. I designed the Cyborg Camp logo back then, and so Amber and I tend to keep in touch a lot because we're both Twitter connected tech nerds, and so I went to check it out, and it was actually my favorite conference of that year. It actually beat out Web Visions and WordCamp in my mind, even though those are both terrific events. What was wonderful about Cyborg Camp was just this intimate feel, and just Amber has a really great way of, and I know this is going to sound arrogant now that I'm a part of this, and really what I would like to frame this as is that I'm actually really terrified by this, but to be in the company of this really eclectic but awesome group of innovators such as, past speakers include Ward Cunningham, who invented the wiki, and Bill, and I'm going to butcher Bill's last name probably, but Bill DeRouche, he's Bill Durr on Twitter, who up till recently was interactive director at Zeba, and these folks just talked about really amazing things. And what's really a misunderstanding about Cyborg Camp is that it's all for web developers, and it's really not. It's really those people will love it. Web designers and developers will love it. Programmers and hackers and tinkerers will love it. But anyone who's interested in technology and specifically the impact of technology on human existence should really enjoy it. And so it's kind of out of my box in that regard because it's not a strictly web design conference. So I'm going to be speaking about the effect of... The talk has been advertised as popular culture mirroring the human condition. I'm 99% sure that will not be what the talk is actually called. That was just kind of a synopsis I gave Amber. But I basically want to explore this sort of man-machine dichotomy. So you see it in all our media. You see it in, you know, stuff like The Matrix and Terminator 2, and you see it in Isaac Asimov writings and stuff like this. And contrast that with some design and some art conventions about sort of this, to bluntly use a metaphor, why is it that every cycle of personal computing we're starting to see this pattern of having the open, controllable, customizable platform versus the hermetically sealed but really easy to use platform? And it seems to be a pattern there. And do we need both? And what does that say about us as human beings? And so it's not going to have it probably won't have any HTML snippets in it at all. So it's probably going to have a lot of really nerdy references, and it may be my first presentation that utilizes some music and some video as well. But I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be outside my box of what I usually speak about, and hopefully everyone will dig it. But yeah, so get your tickets as soon as you can so you can get them cheaper. It includes breakfast and lunch and coffee, I believe. I may be wrong about lunch. It may be breakfast, lunch, coffee, and drinks. Plus $10. So theoretically, you would probably spend more than $10 on those two meals in the day anyway. So even if you just go just to save a buck on foodstuffs, it'll probably be neat. And what's really cool too is that this year, there's a bunch of great sponsors, but I'm most intrigued by Palm being one of the sponsors, which is pretty cool. So yeah, folks should definitely attend.
Yeah, and I can say it's very easy. I've now signed up and am all ready to go. So not that I wasn't paying attention or anything. I think that your talk sounds interesting, and I was definitely intrigued by the first title, and I was hoping that I could hear a little bit more about what it was, but I was also willing to wait until you actually gave it. But I must say I'm excited to hear I'm excited to see some audio and video that ends up happening.
Max Ogden is going to be speaking there too, and he's the guy who did the PDX API, which is really neat if you want to build any app that utilizes Portland city information, like transportation and a bunch of different stuff. He's an amazing hacker, and apparently he's also a bit of a heavy metal geek. His talk should be pretty cool. And he has one of the most magnificent beards in the Portland tech community. So that sets him apart as well.
Well, that's awesome.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that might bring us to close to the end. I must say that I believe this is the longest we've spoken, but it's been all exciting stuff.
Well, we're making up for the gap.
That's true.
We had too few weeks, and people probably thought we were quitters. We probably thought, like, those guys, they recorded two episodes, someone yelled at them about Flash on Android devices, and now they threw in the hat. And no, we've desperately wanted to. I think we've had to cancel twice. I think once it happened because life just got in the way. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said before, I got sick with something horrible, And luckily that's done now, and here we are. And although part of me is thinking, well, what if Murphy's Law rears its ugly head, and as soon as we press end call, the files like blow up or something.
It's very possible. I need to save.
That's true. That's true. We should save. But yeah, Peter, it was awesome talking with you, and let's try to do these more often.
Yeah, we'll talk, maybe even weekly. We could go for that again.
Thanks to everyone who's listening out there. Again, you can find the podcast at friendselectric.com. It should redirect you to podcast.friendselectric.com until such time as we have something else to showcase on there as well, but we'll make sure it's still easy for you to find the podcast when that happens. And thank you for listening. Peter, is there anything you need to plug or anything you want to talk about before you go?
I do not think that I need to plug much at all.
Well, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me at peterwoolley.com, and I am quite active on Twitter at my username is my name, Peter Woolley.
Cool, and I am at tylerstica.com, and my username is tylerstica as well. We don't get too creative with our usernames. We
no.
like to be easy to find. But yeah.
Simple before clever, right?
Yep, exactly. Yep. Well, I'm going to go ahead and completely ape Leo Laporte for this one. Another episode of the Friends Electric Podcast is in the can.